to get in touch with my personal powerlessness. My sobriety date is March the 27th, 1985. So I've been around a while. And that concept of powerlessness has gotten larger and larger and larger as the years go by. So in this shutdown, I'm 72 years old. 3 years ago, I had a liver transplant, so I take immune suppressants. So I'm a prime candidate to get killed off by this thing. So I've been staying home and pretty religiously. People sneak over here and smoke cigars with me in the backyard and stuff, but nobody wants to be responsible for killing me off. So I've been isolated pretty good here. Fortunately, I have a big backyard, so we can spread out and we can still get some people here. And as time has gone on, everybody, the pressure of just being away from each other has gotten really great. And I don't think we do well when we're apart from each other. This Zoom thing has been really fascinating. At first, I was kind of resistant, not like some people, but you know, it's new and it's different. I'm not that computer illiterate. I've been around them for a long time. I'm not real techie, but I'm not afraid of them. But at first, I was kind of just, oh my God, now we got to do this. And the first couple of times you speak into a computer screen and you can't get the feedback that you usually get from an audience, it's just weird. But I have gotten really used to it, man. And I've gone to more AA in the last couple of months than I've done in years. It's just, I've been all over the world, not just speaking, but hanging out. I've been going to a small meeting in Moscow of about four or five people. You know, a friend of mine got hooked up into it, and I've just been showing up there. You know, it's been fascinating. And I think we've gotten more access to Alcoholics Anonymous than we had before. You know, those of us have been around, we don't have the kind of access we're used to, but people are getting sober on Zoom, man. People are coming into their first AA meeting on Zoom, and they're getting sober. I'm reading the book with guys over Zoom, you know, and FaceTime. I mean, there's just more access. I've always been good at answering the phone, not so good at using the phone, but I've been trying to call people that I know are really struggling with this. You know, I've helped some people learn how to figure out the technology and shamed them into going to meetings. Come on, man, don't be a weenie. Come and join us, you know, that kind of thing. Just talking to people, trying to reach out, because I know there's some people that are all alone. You know, I'm fortunate that I live with somebody that I like. That isn't everybody's situation, you know. I have a gun guy that calls me from his garage. He's got married and got two kids, man. He's sleeping in the garage, you know. So so I think this has been a good thing. I don't think it's going to go away either. But I've got a new thing that I've been thinking about. I've been sitting here thinking. I've been thinking a lot, you know, and I've come up with some ideas that I really like. I always like my ideas. And I get ideas, and then I form opinions around them. And I really like the opinions. I mean, I agree with all the opinions that I construct. And I have verification and I give it veracity. You know, I back it up with notes. I've even written some things down. I had such good ideas, I've written some stuff down. And I am gonna burden you with some of them tonight. And I hope you agree with me. It's always better when you agree, you know, and plus we're on Zoom, so you can't really throw anything at me or anything. So you can just, and don't unmute yourself and yell at me, you know, just leave the meeting. So here we go. Here's what I've been thinking about. It says in our book, that big blue one, it says that the only thing that's going to keep me sober, and even almost some kind of more importantly, or an extension of that, give me a decent life with a purpose in it, maybe some healthy relationships and that kind of thing, like a good life, you know, where there's peace in it and there's some serenity. The only thing that's really going to give me that is my spiritual condition. So evidently, we need one of those. This process that we all agree upon, even if we don't do it, we agree on the way out. We agree, even if we're not doing it, we agree what it is. It's the 12 steps. It is a spiritual path. And it is supposed to, in the process of doing that, develop some kind of spiritual condition. Sometimes I think we repeat that a lot. You know, we repeat it, but do we really know what makes up a spiritual condition? And evidently, this spiritual condition requires some maintenance. We're supposed to maintain this spiritual condition. And it says they have a couple of stories in there where the people didn't maintain their spiritual condition and they drank and everything went to hell. You know, it also says that we have these things called laurels. And evidently we can rest on them. And that we're not supposed to do that. We're not supposed to rest on the laurels, whatever those are. And so I've been thinking about that. What are these laurels that I can rest on? And what is spiritual condition? And do I have one? Right? Do I have one? What's it look like? And what's it made up of? And I had an experience. What caused me to think about this is about a month or so before this whole shutdown, the last airplane trip I took before all this went to hell, is I flew from LA up to Sonoma and to speak at a men's conference up there. And this guy picks me up and he's about my age, same age group. And you can tell by his demeanor, he's been around AA a long time. And we're in the car together and we're talking and he asked me, he says, how long you been sober? And at the time I was coming up on my 35th AA birthday. And I was pretty proud of that. So I said very proudly, I said, if I don't drink in the car on the way to this event, I got a good shot at getting 35 years. And he smiled and he said, yeah, I almost had 30 years. So you knew it was going to be an interesting conversation. And he tells the story. He tells the story about being an AA and really liking AA, doesn't have any resentments, married to an AA woman that he met in the fellowship, they've been married a long time, coming up on retirement, things are pretty good, he's happy, right? And he's kind of resting on his laurels, he's not going to as many meetings, doesn't have any commitments, and, you know, that kind of thing. But he's going to meetings, he's seeing his buddies and hanging out and living the good life, right? So he had some kind of surgery and they gave him some pain medication. And he's taking it as prescribed. Then one day he took two instead of one, so he'd feel a little bit better. Common story in AA. And that set it off. And he went down the slide after some time. He started drinking. Everything went to hell. 3 years went by and he comes crawling back into AA. When he's telling me this story, he's a year and a half, 2 years sober. Glad to be back. And he's got a commitment. He's driving the speaker around. You know, he's back in the fellowship. Didn't lose his marriage and stuff. And it really got my attention. Because I'm sitting there, this guy is me. He's me. He's me. You know, and he, usually when you hear about somebody drinking, it isn't a real dramatic thing. Somebody hands you a drink, somebody hands you a joint and you smoke it and you don't even think about it and it just happens. Usually that's what happens. And so it really got my attention. I flew back to LA the next day and I had to speak that night. And I spoke at a local meeting and this girl gets up, a woman gets up and she's a 10-minute speaker and she tells the same story. You know, she had 10 years and some stuff happened and she ends up drinking. Now she's back a couple of years. And I said to myself, pay attention, Bill. Pay attention. Pay attention. Mr. AA guru, pay attention. And so I started thinking about this, you know, and I called my sponsor. Shockingly, I've been talking to my sponsor a lot lately. I figure he needs me. You know, I've had the same sponsor for 35 years. So here's what the conclusion I've come up to, what spiritual condition is. When I was 17, I was a bad drunk in high school. I had a big jacket and a slouch and a sneer and a foul mouth and a bad attitude, and I carried a gun. And I'm from the mean streets of Palos Verdes. There's no gangs in Palos Verdes. Nobody's looking for me. But at 17, I was drinking pretty much every day, you know, drinking before high school and getting loaded and failing out. And that kid, I was one of those guys. I was one of the bad kids behind the backstop. And I had been that way for a few years by then. And when I got sober, I was 37 years old. So I was out there drinking and using pretty hard for 22, 23 years, very hard. By the time I was 22, I was in a mental institution. And I was running with an outlaw motorcycle gang and sticking needles in my arm and drinking like a fish. And I had gotten married and had two kids. And I wasn't coming home to them and they were on welfare and it was awful. So it was a very short party. You know, very, I didn't know there was a line to cross. I just started drinking alcoholically right away, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And it led to all the other stuff that happens in the 60s and the 70s and 80s and the 90s, and, you know. And I had another 15 years to go after that, and I got to Alcoholics Anonymous at 37. Whenever any speaker tells their story, like I'm telling right now, almost anyone, I don't know that I've heard one that didn't say this one particular thing. Long before I drank, I didn't feel part of. I felt strange, odd, weird, outside the circle. Nobody gave me the rule book. Everybody else had the formula, and I didn't. And I felt weird and separate from. And we talk about that usually like it's an aspect of alcoholism. You'll hear people say, I had the ism long before I ever drank. I had alcoholic thinking, as if there is such a thing, right? You know what the professional community says about us? They say that we are emotionally immature. And we hear that and we go, no, I have special thinking. I have alcoholic thinking and it's never going away. And you need to consider that when you're dealing with me. And I'm pretty convinced that my thinking isn't that special. I don't think I'm that extraordinarily neurotic. I don't think alcoholics are much different than any other human being on the planet. What makes us different than them is we have alcoholism, that when we drank, we don't know how to stop. We can't control it. It's alcoholism. There's no special thinking. We're like any other human being. The ego presents itself at about 2.5 years old. We have a name for that. We call it the terrible twos. You know, our speaker before us had talked about having a little baby. She's experienced that recently. You know, prior to the ego presenting itself in the child, the little kid's just a parasite, just this little lump. And it has no consciousness whatsoever that there's a separation between it and anything. That hasn't arrived yet. That part of the consciousness that tells us that we're separate hasn't shown up. And at 2.5, it shows up. And the kid immediately starts manipulating the situation. It realizes, when I cry, they come. So there must be a me and a they. And when I cry, they show up. So it starts crying a lot. It has a lot of needs, you know, and if it's living in a halfway decent household, it'll get those needs fulfilled. And thus begins the cycle, right? Manipulating those around us in order to get what we need. Fast forward to that to an adult. You ever heard somebody recently say, I had to break up with that woman because I wasn't getting my needs met? Doesn't that just give you the willies? I bet you there's a lot of you out there that have actually said that. Out in the parking lot outside the meeting, you know? It wasn't get, because that's why we're in the relationship, right? Is to get our needs met. I am not whole without you. I require you to facilitate me. What a burden to lay on another human being. Can you imagine that? If that's what you're in the relationship for, is in order to fulfill your needs, because you can't do it yourself. Someone else is responsible for you being happy. What are the odds of that situation being successful? I've been in several relationships that look like that, you know? I've been married 3 times. Jesus. So in elementary school, we've all had this experience. Every one of us, alcoholic, non-alcoholic, everyone has this experience where you're sitting in the classroom, second or third grade, fourth grade, somewhere in there, and you look across the room and you say to yourself, if I had nice, beautiful, long, blonde hair like that guy over there, I'd be cooler instead of this curly piece of shit on my head. If I was taller like Joey, I'd be cooler. If I was more athletic like Sammy, I'd be cooler. Things would be better for me. I'm not good enough. I need to look like that kid. We start dressing like them. We get sold this stuff all the time. I need to be different. I need to have better glasses. I need to have this. I need to have that. I need to work out more. I'm too fat. I'm too skinny. There's always something. We compare ourselves to other people. That is a human experience. The job of the ego is to create separation. In order for there to be reality, there has to be subject, object. And we grow up with this idea that we are separate, physically separate. We're out of the circle. We're outside something. And some of us come from dark places that no kid should be raised in. And that situation is even magnified by that. This, the need for survival. The ego is a survival mechanism. It's warning us about stuff. That person's talking about you behind your back. Look out for that guy over there. He's a bully. Be careful of them. Don't get that constantly. is constantly looking for stuff to protect us. It's projecting into the future, worrying about situations that haven't occurred yet, and in reflecting on what we should have done in the past that wasn't good enough. Constantly. That's a human experience. That is not an alcoholic experience. What happens to us is somewhere in this learning process of growing up, we start medicating that feeling. We medicate it. Thus is the problem. How do we grow out of self-centeredness? Children are appropriately self-centered. That's why they drive us nuts. They're more self-centered than we are, their competition. But they are appropriately self-centered. They're going to grow up and have a series of experiences that cause them to grow out of that in order to have healthy, productive relationships. They're going to cheat on girlfriends, and girlfriends are going to cheat on boyfriends, and they get in trouble, and they learn about that, and it's not good, and they feel bad, and they stop behaving that way in order not to be in trouble. They learn how to deal with authority. When authority tells them something to do and they don't want to do it, they learn how to manipulate that to get through the situation, so that they don't get in trouble because they don't want to end up in jail or in the principal's office. And maybe sometimes they end up there. And then they learn about that. That's not good. Keep your mouth shut. Growing up is experiential. It's not intellectual. You have to have experiences that cause you to understand what's going on and then adjust accordingly and grow up. You and I missed all that. Most of us started drinking at 13, 14, 15, some of us even earlier. Some of us started drinking real hard like I did right away. Others build up to it. And so some of us are a little more emotionally immature than others. Some of us got some of the lessons, but not all of them. Some of us didn't get any at all. You and I have met people in Alcoholics Anonymous that have virtually no social skills whatsoever. Maybe they lived in I've sponsored guys that grew up, never had driver's license, lived in burned out houses and shit. You know, those guys, they ask you some really interesting questions like, how do you ask a girl out for a date? And they're not kidding. They don't know. They've never done it. It's shocking when you run into that. It's also kind of breaks your heart. I've sat and read the book with guys that can't read, and they've kept that secret for years and years, and they're 40 years old and they can't read, and they'll start crying because now you know. No extra charge in AA, you get to learn how to read. I've helped guys learn how to read. I've seen guys get up and read chapter 5, and you know they've memorized most of it, and they take great pride in being able to say the whole thing without making a mistake. That's the love in AA. So we missed it all. So I get to Alcoholics Anonymous at 37 years old, and on a good day, I've got the emotional development of a 16-year-old, and this kid was not an honor student. He's not the one that's mature beyond his years. He's the one with a bit of a problem with authority, and he looks grown up, but he's not. When I got sober, I was on my second marriage, and we had my second set of two kids. The daughter was 3, and the little boy was 4 months old. Few years ago, we had a party over here at my house, and my daughter and my son were over here. My daughter's 38 now, school teacher, married, got my grandkids, right? And she's standing there, she looks at me, and she goes, you know, Dad, you've grown up quite a bit over the years. And I was really pleased to have her acknowledge that fact. Because I'm years sober, and I'm getting kicked off a soccer field for attacking the referee in the middle of the game for a bad call. Sober years, sponsoring guys, you know, talking a good talk and then going out in the soccer field. I've stood at a chain link fence at a baseball game with my fingers through the fence screaming and the spit flying out of my mouth and be escorted off the field by our coach, right? You know, it's stuff. I have a series. I've worn the clown suit many times. I keep it in my closet still. I dust it off every once in a while. It's been a while since I put it on, but I've come close recently, you know. But I'm a hell of a lot better. You know, the rage is gone. The rage is gone. That rage is gone. I just get pissy. My wife still doesn't like the pissy, but the rage is gone. I've gotten better. So this is what I think's going on in sobriety is we're growing up. You ever heard somebody that's been sober quite a while stand up at a podium and say the thing, don't ever tell an alcoholic what to do. We don't like to be told what to do. Never tell us what to do. If you tell us what to do, we'll just do the opposite. We're alcoholics. We don't like to be told what to do. Now, when you're 14 or 15 years old, that can be appropriate, maybe even cute. When you're 40, it's just stupid, right? It's just stupid. There's nothing special about our thinking. We're just childish and immature. We're not sensitive. We're touchy. To be sensitive, you have to have a striation of emotions. And the depth of my shallowness is unbelievable, you know? So here's what happens. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and two things happened that I think are just pure luck. The first one is probably the most important. I just liked it. I just liked it. Nothing would have led you to believe in my past that I would walk into AA and just like it. But I liked it. I got the joke right away. I remember driving home after that first meeting that night, and I thought to myself, you know, this may not be so bad. It was at the Hermosa Beach Alano Club. It was a Friday night meeting. All the Harleys were parked on the street. It was at 1985. You know, everybody's all dressed up trying to score. It's a Friday night meeting. It was all crazy and loud, and a lot of hoorah and shouting out the steps and just all this craziness. It was not what I was expecting. I stood in the back of the room and I didn't feel part of, because I wasn't, right? It wasn't an odd feeling. I wasn't. I didn't know anybody. I was new. And I left home and I drove home that night and I thought, this may not be so bad. That was fun. And I found myself laughing. I mean, I got the joke. That's how you catch alcoholism. If you start laughing at this stuff, because they don't laugh at this stuff down at the Rotary Club, you know, this is different. And the second thing happened is I asked a guy to help me and he actually did, which doesn't always happen. He said to me, go home and read the doctor's opinion, make notes in the margin of what you agree with and what you don't, and be at my house Thursday at 5 o'clock and we'll discuss it. So I read my assignment, I made my little notes, and I showed up at his house at 5 o'clock, and he did not trust me that I'd read it, and he had me read it to him out loud. And each week I went to his house and we read another chapter and he talked with me. He got to know me, we shared our lives together. At 6 months sober, I did a fifth step. And I had an experience after that fifth step. And what the experience was is I went home. He told me, he says, when you go home today, think about the guy that's walking through that door today compared to the guy that walked through that door 6 months ago. And I did that. I stopped on my porch, on my front porch, and I thought about that. And something struck me. What struck me was, it's going to be like this now. Now, I wasn't really sure exactly what this was. I had 6 months of being around it, so I had an inkling, but I didn't know really what this was. I think what I really knew was that the old life, whatever that was, is over. That's remarkable. That's remarkable. That was an awakening. What's it going to be like? So far, so good, by the way. So far, so good. 35 years. That's a long damn time. My life has completely changed. On March the 27th, 1985, I was awakened. The rest of that journey is to have that awakening evolve into an awareness where I'm aware that I'm awake and maybe there's something I can do with this. Maybe there's a reason why I'm here. So what's the very first concept that these people lay on us when we walk in here? The very first thing that we've got to grab a hold of, the very first step, powerlessness. So the first pillar of spiritual condition is some understanding at some depth of the idea, the concept of powerlessness. But with us, it's not really a concept, is it? It's an experience. We have experienced powerlessness. Now, they took it easy on us, and they just said it was drugs and alcohol because they didn't want us to run screaming down the street. And what I've discovered and experienced after 35 years is I am utterly and completely powerless over absolutely everything. And every time I try to assert myself to change the way things are, I run headlong into it again. You see it right now. we are shut down. We're not going to work. We're not meeting together. And that feeling of powerlessness can be very disturbing, especially when it's society-wide. That's why we create conspiracy theories. It makes us feel better, like we understand what's going on and we have some control, because I understand the conspiracy and you don't. That's an egoic thing, isn't it? We try our hardest to have some control over the situation. It couldn't be just random insanity. That's too frightening. So we'll create a conspiracy so that we feel better about it, like we've got an edge up on those other people. That's a classic egoic thing, right? I think the universe, by its very nature, is a giving entity. It's supplying us with everything we need. I just take exception to what's being supplied. I think it should be something different than it is. I'm not getting what I want. But if you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need. The great sage Mick Jagger, right? The great spiritual teacher. And I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true. I've always been taken care of. I'm 72 years old. I've almost died a couple of times, and I made it through. I don't think that's anything odd, but it does, when you're in a situation like that, it sure brings the truth to you. I've always been taken care of, maybe not to my liking, but I don't think there's anything I'm missing that I need to go get. I don't think I require any power. Isn't that odd? It says lack of power was our dilemma. Well, that's a dilemma. Does it say that we need to go get some? Some people would interpret it that way, and I get it. I understand it. But my experience tells me I'm utterly powerless. I'm utterly powerless. If I can grasp this just a little bit, the second step then becomes operational. I need to go find some. I need to connect with it. I need to be restored to sanity, and it can't be from me because I'm powerless. I mean, that's the whole idea behind that, isn't it? I can't fix me. I have not been able to fix me. So have an open mind. Maybe there's something that will fix me. Maybe there's something there. Who cares what it is? If I can do that a little bit, the third step then becomes operational. Now, the third step's interesting because it says that I'm going to make a decision to turn my life and will over to clearly what already has it anyway. I'm glad they led me to believe that I actually have some say in the matter. But I've been withholding myself from the totality of all things long enough. I'm going to acquiesce now and allow you to take me. Thank you very much. Where's my trophy? Right? And my little 2.5-year-old ego just loves the idea of me having a battle of wills with the power that drives the entire universe, you know? How could there possibly be a difference between my will and God's will? We talk about that a lot. I'm trying to find out what God's will is. Look out the goddamn window. There it is. It's what's happening right now. This is it. Oh no, it couldn't be that. This is not right. Now I suffer. Because this is incorrect. And I suffer. We have such a problem with this, we've created this thing called hope. We've created a fantasy land in the future where things are going to be good, because right now it's just awful. It couldn't be this. This could not be it. This is incorrect. There's a sense of injustice. That someday in the future when things are good, the lion will lay down with the lamb. I bet if that happens, that lamb is going to be nervous for eternity. It is the nature of the lion to eat the lamb. There's no morality in it. There's no morality in nature. We add that to the equation. We look out in the world and we say some stuff is good and other stuff is bad. And the person who lives right next door to us feels exactly the opposite about those things. The good stuff we think, they think is bad. So we add the morality. It is completely nebulous. It's arbitrary as hell. There's no morality in nature. Everything out there is eating something else out there. That just seems to be the way it is. And we add the morality, and we suffer because of that. We suffer. So what life and will is it talking about in the third step? The inventory. The end result of living a life with seeming power, resentment, fear, and broken relationships. That's what I come to you with. You know, I'm filled with resentment because everything is their fault. I have fear. I don't even know I have fear. I have anger. I think I'm angry, but it's fear, isn't it? A lot of us cover up the fear with anger. And I'm clueless. I don't know. I'm not conscious of that. But I'm filled with fear because I have no plan B. My plan isn't working and I have no plan B. And I'm filled with fear. So if what I'm bringing to the table is fear and resentment, what could my relationships be like other than dramatic and traumatic? All of them. All of them. When wasn't I selfish would be a shorter list in that. This brings us to the second pillar of spiritual condition. What we discover in the inventory, what we're looking for, is that fourth column of the resentment list, right? It doesn't say what is my part. It says, what are my faults and mistakes? That's what it says. What are my faults and mistakes? So what we're looking for is we're going to look for my culpability in everything that's happened to me. I have to stop the blaming. Pillar number two, stop the blaming. If it's your fault, if it's something outside of me, there truly is no hope for recovery because I'm powerless over all of that. I have to stop the blaming. High school is over. All I need to know about my childhood is it's over. And it was extraordinarily long, well into my 40s. It's time for me to grow up. What is one of the first examples of indicators of self-centeredness? Blaming. Never taking responsibility. For the alcoholic life to seem like the only normal one, it has to be someone else's fault. I can't own it because there's no justification for my behavior. There has to be a reason why I'm behaving this way. I go to my sponsor and I had a screaming fight. I'm 6'5". And when I'm in good shape, I'm 230 pounds. I'm a big dude. And my wife was like 5'3". And I'm leaning over and screaming in her face, stone cold sober. And I go to my sponsor and I explain to him what it was she said to me that caused me to scream at her like that. Because I can behave that way because you've done something to cause me to behave that way. It doesn't come from a vacuum. If you behaved yourself, I would not act the way I'm acting. It's your fault, and that's my justification. All he said to me was, stop screaming at your wife. I had to explain it to him a second time because he clearly didn't hear me. This is what she did that caused me to behave that way. He did not care about that, and he just kept saying to me, stop screaming at your wife. I remember driving home from that thing thinking, man, this is not therapy, is it? It's not therapy. He didn't want to get down to the deep underlying reasons for my, he just said, stop screaming at your wife. Grow up. Stop it. I have to stop blaming. And the fifth step is where we physically and literally turn it over, don't we? We tell somebody else, and probably the first time in our lives, we tell ourselves. This is what I've done. This is who I hate. This is why I hate them. And this is how I reacted to that and how it made me feel. Now that you're awake, if you were awakened, I think what happens to us when we get sober is we wake up. So I'm not asleep anymore. I'm awake. I grasp the powerlessness thing. I've got a little bit handle on it. It only takes about 20, 25 years to really get powerlessness. But, you know, I've got a little bit. I get the idea, the drugs and the alcohol part. I've got that down pretty good. I'm reading the book with you. I'm getting it. You know, I got the powerlessness and I stopped the blaming. I'm stopping the blaming. So we get to 6 and 7, the character defects, right? You don't have to make a list. You can if you want to, because now that you're awake and you're not blaming, they will come and visit you with alarming regularity. And you're not asleep anymore. And hopefully, if you're lucky, you're hanging around with some other people in AA that are on a similar path as you, so they won't co-sign your bullshit. Right? That's what happened to me, because you're going to continue the behavior. But every time you do it, you're going to walk away from it and you're not going to feel good, you know? And if you've got some good support around you, you're going to have to go back and apologize for what you said and what you did Doesn't matter whether it was a justifiable yelling match or whatever it is. You just can't get away with that anymore. You got to cut it out. It's time to grow up. Right? That's what's happened to me. Then they get you into the ninth step. Now we're going to make amends. This is really a conundrum, because these people that you don't like that caused all the misery in your life, they're telling you, these people are telling you, you're going to go to them and apologize to them, and they owe you. What the hell is that? That can't possibly work. That makes no sense. But you've committed, right? You're going to do it. And you know, you get an inkling now. I get it now. I got to do this. I got to do these things. Some of them are really obvious. Some of them you really owe the money. You really need to do it. You need to apologize. But some of them are hard. The one at the top of my list was my father. I hated my father, and he didn't like me much either. I was the spawn of Satan. You know, I was a bad kid. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I did some awful crap, and I got caught frequently. I was a bad criminal. And they were always there, you know, in jails, and just all the stuff that happened with me. It was awful. It's probably very similar to you. You know, very repetitive and pathetic and embarrassing a lot. And I knew I had to go to this guy that I really didn't like, and I thought he owed me, and I had to go to him. I had to do it. And I went up there. I wrote some stuff down. I didn't know what to say. I told my sponsor, I said, man, I don't know what to say. What do I say to this guy? You know, and he says, well, why don't you tell him that you're sorry that you weren't the kid that you know he wanted you to be? Something like that. So I wrote some stuff, and I kind of rehearsed it, went over it with the sponsor. And I went up and I sat down with him, and I said, I know I wasn't the son that you wanted me to be, and I'm really sorry about my behavior. You're my father, and I love you, and I don't want to hate you anymore. And I didn't even really mean that, but I said it to him. You know, I knew, and I said it, and I looked him right in the eye. I was raised like that. You go to them, you look them in the eye. Like, if you want to get the bang for your buck, it's a hard thing to do. You might as well go all out, really do it, and see what happens. You know, take a risk. This is a big risk. Bill Wilson said the sixth step is what separated the men from the boys. I think it's nine. You know, six, yeah, but nine, man, that's a hard. Most people in AA don't really do this. And they tell you that they can't get quiet their head because they can't meditate, because they can't quiet their head. And you ask them, have you done your ninth step? Have you gotten rid of all the crap? Maybe that'll quiet it down. Maybe that's where you need to start. Do that. I've been around long enough where you have these conversations with people. You do this little rant, and they come up and say, can we talk? And the guy's 20 years sober. And in the conversation, you say, well, have you done this? Have you done the steps? And he goes, yeah, oh, yeah, I've done the steps. And then there's a pause, and they look at you, and they say, not like what you're talking about, though. I haven't done that. Now, what am I talking about? Some right-wing fundamentalist approach to AA? I think this is straight ahead, down the middle of the road, do it kind of AA. You know, there's nothing radical about any of this. Yeah. After I did that amends with him, when I drove home that night with my wife in the car, I broke down and started sobbing deep down inside, just unwillingly. It just happened. It was that when you do the ninth step, this is when the transformation really begins. When you go to these people that you don't ever want to see again, and you look them right in the eye, and you say the words that need to be said, you try to mend the situation, you pay back the money, you do what you have to do. When you turn and walk away from that experience, you are changed right then and there. It's called a cathartic experience. That event will change you right then. You don't have to wait for the effect. It'll happen right now. And these people that say you've been your own worst enemy, put yourself at the top of the list, that'll pretty much kill you. Put yourself at the bottom of the list. By the time you get there, you'll have some self-esteem. That's what happened to me. You know, that goes along with, you got to learn to love yourself before you can love others. If I work on loving me, I will never get to you. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. I don't need to be trying to love me. I will love me when I get done with this. Now there'll be something to really grab a hold of. When I went down that nine-step list, I started getting some self-esteem. I was maybe a year sober when I started doing this, and I remember that when I looked in the mirror and I could actually look myself in the eye. That's a hard thing to do, you know, when you don't have a lot of self-worth. And I started getting some self-worth. Matter of fact, I went around and told everybody in AA that I'm a badass AA, man. I'm really doing this and you're not. I mean, that the ego was still there, you know. I mean, I was like, You know how they say do something really nice for somebody, then don't tell anybody else? I don't know that I've ever accomplished that. If you don't know about the good stuff I've done, I don't think it really happened. I want the accolades for it. I want the hash marks, you know? And that's okay. It doesn't matter what your motivation is. If you do the work, you'll get the results out of it sooner or later. This brings us to the third pillar of spiritual condition. In the ninth step, what we learn is nothing is personal. Nothing. Nobody is doing anything to me. They're just doing what they do, and I happen to be in the blast radius of it. And sometimes you're in my blast radius, but nobody is doing anything to me. And it sure feels personal, doesn't it? I mean, that's part of the blaming thing. You know, we're real justified in that. And then now they come and tell us nothing's personal. Any spiritual path that I've looked and I've been down some roads over the years I've studied, I find it fascinating. Any spiritual path worth its salt teaches this. The disidentification with self. Nothing is personal. Nothing. Things just are. Stuff just is. It's just happening, right? When I made amends to my father, he was sober. He's sober. He got sober in 1954. His sobriety date was March the 28th. Mine is March the 27th. Isn't that remarkable? For 15 years after that, we gave each other birthday cakes in the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag on the same night. We healed. We healed our relationship. You know what I realized through that experience? He wasn't doing anything to me. He was just doing what he did. He was this kid from Alabama, you know, grew up in the Depression, you know, worked his ass off all of his life, you know, and he was a little distant and aloof, didn't really know how to emote and show feelings much because those people just didn't do that. You know, I found out he was pretty cool. Everybody loved him. I hated him. Everybody loved my dad. That always shocked me when people would talk about what a wonderful man your father is. They go, what? You're kidding me. Maybe there was something wrong with me. What do you think? Maybe I was taking stuff personal that just simply wasn't. Maybe I was alcoholic and he didn't like that because he was alcoholic. Maybe he was pissed off at me for being a loser. You think so? Maybe he retaliated when he shouldn't have. Maybe that's what was going on. But was he doing anything to me? No, not at all. Not really. 10 years after I made amends to him, when I didn't need it, when the relationship was safe, then he made amends to me. Don't leave before the miracle. He made amends to me when I didn't need to hear anything from him, when it was all over. And he cried. And those guys never cried. Those guys never cried. It was so shocking. My mother was sitting at the table. It was so shocking when because he never said he was sorry either. And when he did that, my mother got up from the table and walked away. She didn't know what to do. It was shocking. You know, nothing is personal. 1 through 9 is about 10% of the program. It's not the work. It's not the work everybody talks about. It's Sober 101. It's the first semester. It's the bare minimum. It's what we have to do to build a message that has some depth and weight with some experience so that we can do the work. 10, 11, and 12, 90% of the program. 10, 11, and 12 is the work. 10 is about self-awareness, the fourth pillar of spiritual condition. I'm self-aware now. I'm not just awake. I'm self-aware. I can watch myself move through life. Self-awareness is compared to self-obsession. Big difference. I can be the observer, the watcher of what's going on. The 10th step is about making amends in the present moment. I don't have to write about it, share it with every living human being that crosses my path, go to my sponsor. I know when I've transgressed. I got it. I get it. I shouldn't have said that to that store clerk. I shouldn't have, whatever it is. You know, you turn around, you go back, and I'm sorry. You know, because you get it. Doesn't mean you don't make mistakes. It means that you're aware of it. You're not in denial. You don't have to justify it anymore, bad behavior. You know when you exhibit bad behavior. I know when I exhibit bad behavior. I had to do that so many times in AA. This one guy said, this happened more than once. The guy said to me, Bill, why don't you just quit doing it? It's kind of embarrassing. You're always saying you're sorry. It's like, that pissed me off. And I got a resentment at that guy, you know? I mean, it's a growing, we're growing up, and you can't speed up the process, but you can slow it down by picking and choosing what you will and won't do, right? But you're going to have to live through the experiences for this to come about. At about 10 years sober, I had a mental and emotional collapse. The way I describe it, the sheer weight of carrying my personality around just crushed me, you know, and I fell apart. Everything fell apart. That seems to happen between, you know, 8 and 12 years sober, somewhere in there. People call it the second surrender. I've had more than two. You know, the ones following the second surrender were not as dynamic, dramatic, but they'd happened. 20 years sober, I got really sick, you know, and I had another surrender, another thing. You know, at 10 years sober, it all fell apart, and I had a fall from grace that was stunning. I was a phony AA guru. Was I aware of it? Not really. But I was telling you what to do, and I wasn't doing it. And everything fell apart. And my sponsor told me, go find God. And I yelled at him. I said, I don't need mindless platitudes. I need some real practical help. Don't treat me like some wimpy-ass newcomer. First 10 years I was sober, I was trying to make a name for myself in an anonymous organization. And I had built up, you can claw your way up the AA corporate ladder as long as you believe there is one of those. There's no hierarchy in AA, but I thought there was, and I wanted to be part of it. So I became this guy, and then everything fell apart. My marriage blew up. I ended up living in a storeroom over my office, and he goes, says, go find God. And I almost hit him. And I did an inventory that was just killer, because I knew I had done some work. I knew it was me. I was screaming and yelling about it, but I knew it was me. I knew. And it was embarrassing. It was really embarrassing. And it was very painful, you know. And I did an inventory, and I had to read the 24-hour-a-day book and get on my knees, all that stuff that I think is bullshit. I had to do it all. Today, when I get to the third step with a guy, I look at him and I say, are you ready to do the third step? And the guy says, no. And I said, why not? He says, because I have a problem with God. And I look at him, I go, so do I. Let's pray. The guy says, well, I don't even believe in God. And I go, nobody really does. Let's pray. We're all just whistling in the dark, hoping for the best, buddy, you know? And I've run out of options. How about you? And what I know about that today is that God is an experience. AA is an experience. It's not a concept. And we're human beings. My little ego needs to define and understand things. And we separate it wants its own personal relationship with God, preferably one that's better than yours. And I think God, by its very nature, is impersonal. All there is that. And we make the mistake of thinking we can have our own kind. You know, my friend Steve laughs at me and he says, you're having your personal relationship with your impersonal God. Okay, whatever. You know, but it's an experience. I've experienced it here. I don't need to apply any dogma to it and create a belief mechanism out of it, because I can experience it. That's all I need to know. When I got sober in 85, that was an experience. When I realized that the old life was over, that was an experience. When I did that inventory at 10 years and came out the other side of it and realized what I had done and started making amends and became transparent, which I wasn't before. I couldn't laugh at myself before, and I started laughing at myself. I laugh at me today. I think I'm kind of cute, you know? Have I got a big ego? Well, what do you think? You know? Do I deal with it? I think I deal with it pretty good. I don't hide it anymore and pretend like it isn't there. Why would I do that? There it is. It's kind of hard to miss. You know? Evidently, there's not enough attention in the universe to satisfy me. Am I going to be different than that? How? I'm powerless. The problem is I get plenty of attention. Why do I think I need more than I get? That's the problem, isn't it? Am I doing it to fix myself? God, I hope not. I hope not anymore. I think it's just what I do. This is what I do. This is what I believe in. So the 10th step is about self-awareness. In the 11th step, you can watch yourself think. That's a game-changing experience. You sit quietly, focus on the breath coming in and out of your nose. And the little ego, that construct of who you think you are, in self-awareness, when you become self-aware, this construct of who you think you are that requires defense, you need to defend it and protect it. And it needs to be fed. When it starts to fall apart, there's nothing to defend anymore, is there? Transparency just happens. it's a painful process, but it begins to collapse. In meditation, this egoic construct, it doesn't like being in the present moment. There's nothing for it to do. There's nothing wrong in the present moment. Everything is absolutely as it should be. So there's nothing for it to do. It needs to be in the future where it can chew on things, or in the past where it can go over stuff and what happened. And it takes the past and it projects it into the future over and over and again. It creates nothing. It just takes credit for shit. So it'll wander away from the breath. And you notice that. And you gently bring it back. This is absolute conclusive proof. You are not your thinking mind. That is a game-changing experience. That's not an understanding, an intellectual understanding. It's an experience. Anyone can do this. Once you realize the truth of it, we can finally stop working on ourselves. We're just feeding the beast. It'll take any kind of attention it can get. It's not trying to hurt me. It needs me for transportation. It's not the enemy. It's part of me, but it's not the essence of me. That's a game changer. That changes everything. I don't have to change it. I don't have to adjust it. I don't have to write about every goddamn thing it comes up with and share it with everybody that crosses my path, take it to meetings and unload it on everybody around me. I can just ignore it. I can just ignore it. My friend Dave says he has conversations with it, because what it's trying to do is trying to warn me about stuff. It's trying to protect me, right? And he says when it comes up with something, he says to it, "Thanks so much for trying to help me. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate the input. But I'm going to move on with my day now. Thanks a lot. See you later." And I've started doing that, you know? This brings us to the final pillar. We've got powerlessness. We stop the blaming. We realize that really nothing is personal. We have self-awareness, where this thing starts to fall apart. All spiritual paths talk about the disidentification with self. And what AA does is like any other really great spiritual path, and it is a great one. It's going to take away everything from me that's blocking me from seeing that I already have everything I need. That feeling of separation when I was a kid, was it real? No. We can't possibly be separate from nature. It's not possible. It's physically and literally impossible to be separate from each other or anything in nature. We are all in the same boat. There is no circle. There's no line of demarcation. We are always in the circle. We're just deluded and we can't see it. And that's a human experience. You and I are forced to look at this in order to save our own lives. But we're not the only ones that have this dilemma. There's millions of people out there that are searching for some kind of an answer. I think understanding is the booby prize, because the experience is so delicious. What do we care what it really means? But we're dogma creating machines. We even do it in AA. You know, every line and comma and the number of what's and who's and when's and 15 column expanded versions of the inventory, doing it year after year. Aren't you sick of yourself? It's still my favorite subject, but God, doesn't it stop sometimes, you know? I mean, just a little bit. Isn't it? Maybe just possibly it's not about me at all. Maybe that's the exact thing it's not about, is me. Maybe it's all about me getting out of me. The 12th step. Think about this. We are involved in an organization where people's lives are saved every day. Every day, people's lives are saved here. And what's the vehicle that's used to save those lives? Us. It's us. Faith without works is dead. Really dead. Alan Watts said, true faith is having no belief mechanism at all, is not knowing, not understanding at all, and having that be okay. That's pretty far out. I think Alcoholics Anonymous is like that. The final pillar of spiritual condition, the actual foundation of it, compassion. It's compassion. It was what I've been missing all my life. What kids don't have because they're self-centered. Compassion comes later in life where you can actually feel other people in your life. You grow up and learn to do that. Sometimes having babies will do that, will crack that open, and you feel something you've never felt before. That's compassion. It's kind of scary to love something that much to fear its demise, isn't it? That's a stunning thing. There's a lot of fear in intimacy. You and I don't know much about intimacy. We think intimacy is sex. No, it's not. It can be the celebration of intimacy in a relationship, and in and of itself, just all by itself, it can just be fun. But it's not intimacy. I learned intimacy by working with you. When I was driven by self that first 10 years, right? I sponsored a lot of people. I still do. That's what I do. That's what I do. That's my real job in AA. That's what I do. And the way I do it is the way I was taught to do it. One-on-one, alone in a room together, just me and the other guy. You read a page and I read a page. And whatever conversation needs to come up will come up. And we go through the process of the 12 steps. Isn't that what we felt when we walked into AA? It was compassion. People just loved us for no apparent reason. Matter of fact, we were suspicious of it. We thought they were all gay, you know, whatever was going on. We had all this weird reaction to it because we were uncomfortable in that kind of a closed space. I had been through a lot of therapy for a lot of years, and this guy invited me into his house and sat down alone with me week after week after week. That was an interesting experience. Now I've done that. So what happened in that is I fell in love with you. I fell in love with you. And I didn't realize it till years later. Somewhere in that process, I started thinking more about you than I did me. And I didn't notice. It was very subtle. It happened over time. And now the richness of that is stunning to me. Character defects are obvious. You can see them. What about the parts of us that are missing? Whatever prejudice you have, whatever opinion you have, we'll walk across the room and ask you for help. And if you let it in, it will change you. It's inconvenient all the time. Evidently, I need to be inconvenienced. I've just gotten used to it, you know. But you let them all in. And if we don't do this, we don't get this. This is the heart and soul of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the vehicle. I didn't know that you were the teacher. I thought it was me. And when I really realized that, I felt stupid. I'm so shallow, but I'm not as shallow as I used to be. And you've entered my heart. I have guys that I've sponsored for 20 and 30 years that I've done fifth steps with because I want to break down the hierarchy. I don't believe in it anymore. You know, I am who I am. I'm an AA zealot. I believe it. I live it. I breathe it. I'm retired now so I can do all my time with it. My wife's pissed off at me for Zooming all the time. And she's 30 years sober, you know. She Zooms, you know, a proportionate amount of time. And so we have those kind of thoughts. We have arguments about how much AA we're doing. My God, look how miserable my fucking life is, huh? I'll leave you with this. I know that I've gone on. I get a little excited. But I'll leave you with this, one last thought. They say here you got to give it away to keep it. No, not at all. You have to give it away to even get it. Ooh. That's how you get it. Thank you very much.
Oh my gosh. Let's give Bill one more round of applause. That was like awesome. I've never, ever, since I've been sober, I've ever heard someone take me through the 12 steps.